This morning we have one case on our 10:30 docket. Philip Gregory Bird, Lucy Leasing et al. Versus Philip Galen PC et al. And if the clerk will now announce counsel who will be arguing today, please. All right, Mr. Thomas.
May it please the court. Bruce Thomas for appellants Philip Bird, Lucy Leasing, and PGB Air. The trial court erred in entering a summary judgment for two reasons. Peeler applies to criminal malpractice cases and not civil malpractice cases or cases arising from a civil case. And secondly, Peeler does not apply to contempt, be it criminal or civil. Contempt is not a criminal offense in the sense that that term was used in Peeler. The purpose of Peeler was to add an additional hurdle for criminal malpractice cases, which is not present in civil malpractice cases. That is the exoneration requirement. We've never had an exoneration requirement, of course, in civil cases. If you suffer malpractice in a civil case that ends up giving you a take-nothing judgment, you don't have to appeal that and get a reversal in order to bring a civil malpractice case. In fact, we frequently do just the opposite. We bring the appeal in order to show that the malpractice was so bad that we couldn't possibly get out of it. But there is this additional requirement, this additional layer for criminal malpractice. And essentially, it is to protect the criminal defense bar from strike suits against convicts. The theory being that attorneys would not be willing to engage in this type of practice, particularly representing indigent criminal clients, criminal defendant clients, if they were constantly harassed by frivolous malpractice lawsuits every time the case ended and the client was convicted. Peeler is a particular application of the unlawful acts or outlaw doctrine. So as a matter of public policy in criminal malpractice cases, Peeler does away with a case-by-case analysis of cause and fact and presumes that the client's criminal conduct was the cause of his damages, unless the client can prove he was exonerated by direct appeal, post-conviction relief, or otherwise. Now, there's been a lot of commentary as to whether that's a good enough reason to have this additional requirement in criminal malpractice cases. And it's been seriously questioned outside of Texas, inside of Texas. And the national trend is to reject it, even for criminal malpractice cases. To expand it, to go the opposite direction in Texas and expand it to contempt arising out of civil malpractice cases and to apply it to civil malpractice cases, runs counter to the national trend. It runs counter to the restatement, which provides for additional damages, for mental anguish damages when the attorney's conduct contributes to the client being incarcerated. And it runs counter to the Supreme Court's most recent discussion of Peeler and Duggar versus Arredondo. In the Duggar case, the Texas Supreme Court held that the unlawful acts doctrine was incompatible with the Texas scheme of proportionate responsibility, at least in the context of personal injury and death cases. It rejected the defendant's reliance on Peeler and pre-Peeler cases such as Sachs and Dover that the appellees also rely upon, where the unlawful acts policy was used as a complete bar to the plaintiff's claim, and held that the unlawful acts is just one factor that should be considered in the overall proportionate responsibility adjudged by the jury. Now, the court noted that it had not addressed Peeler in the context of civil malpractice claims, and it left open that question of whether Peeler is appropriately applied to civil defendants bringing a malpractice claim, because that issue was not squarely before the court in that case. Only the personal injury claims were. Of course, that issue is squarely before you. And the same reason that applied in Duggar applies in this case. Proportionate responsibility ought to apply rather than a complete bar based upon any alleged criminal conduct, and certainly not for contempt. Texas law has always allowed a individualized proximate cause determination in civil malpractice cases. A jury can make a proportionate responsibility determination in a civil malpractice case just as it can make in any other negligence case. There would be considerable theoretical difficulties, I think, applying that to a criminal malpractice case, because obviously a major difference between criminal practice and civil practice is we don't have proportionate responsibility in criminal cases. There's no such thing as the defendant being 51% guilty of a crime. But the law in civil cases has always recognized that there can be more than one proximate cause for a civil injury, and that we determine that on the basis of probabilities. So there is no theoretical problem in apportioning fault in a civil malpractice case, and it's inconsistent with the Texas proportionate scheme, the Texas scheme of proportionate responsibility, not to do so in a civil malpractice case as in any other civil case. So, for example, the sanctions order here stated as its grounds that for sanctions that Mr. Byrd had failed to produce any documents and he had provided no written response at all to the plaintiff's document request that had been served approximately a year earlier. And the sanctions imposed a constellation of sanctions against him for that. Death penalty sanctions struck his pleadings, prohibited him from offering any evidence, prohibited him from doing any discovery, prohibited him from making even separate property claims in the divorce action, and among those, the additional sanction of holding him in contempt and committing him to 30 days in jail. Now, we would argue to the jury that in any of the three hearings leading up to where he was progressively ordered to produce documents and respond to discovery before he was held in contempt, if Mr. Spencer had stood up and said, Your Honor, we've had draft discovery responses to document requests in our file from Mr. Byrd for months, and we never got around to filling them out and sending them to the other side. We've had his documents, and we've never gotten around to serving them on the other side. We've had interrogatory answers ready to put in the mail, signed and sworn to, and we forgot about serving them. Then it would probably have been a different result. Certainly, there would have been no finding that he had not produced any response to discovery or not produced any documents. Now, the other side, of course, is free to argue to the jury that Mr. Byrd caused part of his own problems. And if they can make out the case that Mr. Byrd was not diligent in, say, getting some of the bank records he should have gotten, the jury can make that determination that, well, perhaps Mr. Byrd caused 5% or 10% or whatever percent of his fault with respect to the sanctions. And obviously, if the jury determines more than 50%, we lose. But that is still a determination for the jury. And the same for the post-contempt, post-sanction malpractice, the appellate malpractice. If instead of providing a one-paragraph habeas corpus petition, the argument consisted of one paragraph to this court that did not even address the standard of review for habeas corpus. Instead, Bailey Gallion added a second paragraph that had told this court that the contempt order was void because Mr. Byrd had never been served with a show cause order, that he could be held in contempt for violating a discovery order, but instead only received a show cause order with respect to disposing of assets, a matter he was never found to have committed in violation of court order and was not held in contempt for, then probably the habeas decision would have been different. Probably the sanctions would have been redressed if a mandamus had accompanied that habeas appeal to contest the really outrageous sanctions that were imposed upon him for discovery sanctions. I mean, death penalty sanctions is one thing, but depriving him of his constitutional right to separate property is quite another. So again, the jury should be allowed to make that proportionate responsibility determination in a civil malpractice case. The defendant's position is, well, if he was sent to jail for criminal contempt, then all bets are off. We've got a King's X. All the harm that we committed before he was found in contempt, during the contempt proceeding, after the contempt proceeding, none of that matters. As long as he was sent to jail, we have a complete defense to malpractice.
But isn't it the fact of the court's findings in both the contempt order and virtually on the record at the contempt hearing those findings as opposed to the fact that he went to jail as just one of the sanctions. It's more the finding of failure to produce requested documents.
Well, there are two and only two findings. Of course, they didn't request findings of fact. The two findings are that they didn't file a response to a document request, and he didn't provide documents in response to the document request. I would note that generally the client doesn't do that. I mean, particularly preparing the document request, that's the attorney responsibility. That's certainly something I've always prepared on behalf of the client. So even those findings don't directly address Mr. Bird's conduct himself. There's very much a symbiotic relationship, obviously, in responding to discovery in a civil case. And the attorney prepares the discovery responses. The attorney physically delivers the documents or makes them available to the other side. The findings aren't that Mr. Bird never gave documents to his attorney, and Mr. Bird never gave information to his attorney to provide for that. So really, the contempt findings, the contempt order was challengeable on multiple grounds. The defendants concede, I think by their silence, that had Mr. Bird just suffered death penalty sanctions, had he just suffered the loss of his separate property, then there would be, and had it not gone to jail, then there would be no Peeler issue here to discuss. And I think that is a perverse result, that if the attorney's malpractice is so bad as to lead to the client also being held in contempt and incarcerated, then essentially the attorneys get a free pass. It should be just the opposite. The attorney should be held to account for greater damages when their conduct leads to the client being committed to jail. In fact, here, had Bailey Gallion just walked away, that would have been a blessing. But the harm was much greater. Before they walked away, and after the court dismissed their appeal, because there's no right to appeal from contempt, and threw up their hands and didn't do anything else, they scared off the firm that would have represented Bird's corporate entities after they were joined in the lawsuit in the divorce action. The attorney on the other side waited until Mr. Bird was incarcerated and took advantage of that fact in order to bring in his corporate entities, get an injunction against them, and essentially ended up destroying those businesses when they couldn't pay their debts and had the airplanes foreclosed on. Bailey Gallion assured Mr. Bird that they were going to protect those entities, and he told Bailey Gallion that he wanted the firm that had been representing those entities to do so. Instead, that firm was scared off with Bailey Gallion's assertion, and this is what we allege, that Bailey Gallion's assertion that they were to represent those entities, and then they did nothing to protect them. So there was...
But those facts come out in the underlying lawsuit if you get to pursue it. I mean, they're really not relevant to today's question.
Well, they're relevant to the extent that we have these post-contempt actions that the incarceration is at best a tangential part of. It's, yes, they took advantage of the fact that he was incarcerated in order to take the other side, in order to take advantage of his companies, but it wasn't, the harm isn't a solely approximate cause of him of not producing documents in response to the court's discovery order. These are different facts by this time. And it also ties into the fact that the court also dismissed our claims on behalf of the corporate defendants. That, I mean, Peeler provides, if it applies to civil cases at all, it applies when the defendant has been found to have committed a criminal offense. These entities didn't commit any criminal offense. They weren't found in contempt. They didn't do anything. They weren't even a party to the lawsuit at the time. So clearly, Peeler shouldn't apply to the corporate entities. If the policy here for Peeler is respect for the legal system, then I can't imagine any rule that would generate more disrespect for the legal system than a rule that attorneys, if they can get sanctions that are so bad that the client ends up actually going to jail, they effectively get a free pass for all the harm that they've caused beforehand and all the harm that they've caused afterwards. Certainly, Mr. Bird is not trying to profit from his actions. He is asserting the same compensatory damages as any other civil plaintiff in a malpractice case. I have just a bit of time left. Let me address the contempt, the second reason that the court erred in applying Bigler. Well, perhaps I can address that on rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Mr. Smith.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Richard Smith. I represent the appellees, Bailey and Gallion, and Keith Spencer. My plan this morning was to address the two overarching issues first, which are really, I think, is what Mr. Bird did a crime? And if it is, should the sole proximate cause bar of Peeler apply? And then I was going to address what are really the four basic reasons why the appellant says this should be different than Peeler. First of all, with respect to whether it's a crime, I think that if you look at the Supreme Court's language about this very issue in other contexts, I don't think there's any doubt that it's a crime. The Supreme Court has talked about it as being something that requires conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. They call it a crime. They quote from the United States Supreme Court's opinions on the issue that observe, I believe very clearly, that it is a crime in the ordinary sense. Other Texas cases talk about it being, talk about criminal contempt as a crime in every fundamental respect. Of course, as Justice Holmes in this Bloom versus Illinois case that's relied upon by the Texas Supreme Court on this issue observes, if such acts are not criminal, we are in error as to the fundamental characteristic of crime, as that word has been understood in common English speech. So, what Mr. Bird did is a crime, true, not a violation of the penal statute, but it is a crime. And if it is, then we believe that the Peeler sole proximate cause bar should apply for two reasons, really. First, it fits within the holding of Peeler. The appellants focus a lot upon the factual circumstances that give rise to that holding, which is important, but the holding itself applies. The holding in Peeler is that criminal conduct, as a matter of law, is the sole proximate cause of a conviction and any damage that results from that.
Isn't there a difference, though, when the person who commit, let's say somebody commits a bank robbery, their attorney's not right there with them committing the bank robbery. In this instance, you have Mr. Bird, who it is alleged that he didn't turn over documents, but he says he turned them over to his attorneys, and it's not him who responds specifically to discovery requests. So there's factually, there's a difference between a crime and this scenario that at least arguably takes it out of those public policy reasons in that decision, does it not?
Would have two responses to that. First of all, that I think it's important to remember that although Mr. Spencer was representing him at the time and was involved in the representation during the course of discovery, Mr. Bird went to jail because of his own willful and knowing conduct in violating the court order. That's what's required of a criminal contempt. So he wouldn't have been sent to jail for his lawyer's failure to process things. And Judge Quisenberry listened to Mr. Bird on the stand. He heard what he had done and what he admitted to not doing. And Judge Quisenberry determined that that contemptuous conduct warranted the finding of criminal contempt. It wasn't Mr. Spencer's conduct. It was Mr. Bird's conduct. The second point is that the idea that the Peeler public policy reasoning should not apply in a situation where the lawyer is alleged to have been directly involved in the conduct that led to the criminal conviction or directly involved in the criminal conduct, really. That very issue was addressed in Dover and in Sachs, which are the two cases that occurred and led up to the Supreme Court's decision in Peeler. And in fact, in the Duggar versus Arradondo case, the most recent Texas Supreme Court case that talks about those other cases, it notes that the illegal acts rule that it was dealing with in that case is different from the unique circumstances presented in Sachs and in Dover and in Peeler. And I'd like to talk a little bit about Sachs because it speaks to this very issue. It speaks to this very issue about whether or not the lawyer's alleged involvement in the actual criminal conduct can prevent the public policy bar. And in that case involved someone that was convicted of essentially bank fraud, a loan transaction that was fraught with all sorts of problems, and they were convicted of a crime as a result of that. And they sued two collections of lawyers. One of the lawyers that they sued were the lawyers that actually represented them in the loan transaction. The allegations that they made against those lawyers were that they were negligent in preparing the documents, they failed to inform the appellants about the criminal violations that could potentially arise, and they misrepresented the legality of the loan transaction itself. So they were alleging, just like this case, that the lawyers were directly, it was their fault that they did what was criminal. That's what they were alleging. And the court in that case acknowledged the very same issue that's before this court now. They acknowledged that the issue is, can a client who contends that his willful criminal act or criminal conviction directly resulted from his attorney's negligent services sue the attorney for legal malpractice? And the court in that case concluded, we find that the answer in Texas is no. And the reason why was because of the earlier case called Dover, which was a tax fraud case, where that plaintiff alleged the very same thing, that my lawyer told me this was okay. He told me this was legal. He told me it wouldn't be illegal. And he got convicted for the conduct that he engaged in, allegedly as a result of his lawyer's advice. So Dover supported it. That was an earlier case. But the court, more importantly, the court also noted that their conclusion was supported by the Court of Appeals opinion in Peeler. So this came down before the Supreme Court had affirmed the Court of Appeals opinion in Peeler. But what they noted was that even though Peeler involved a malpractice action brought by a criminal defendant against her defense attorney who negligently advised her to plead guilty, the policy relied on by the court is applicable to this case as well. And they noted that the basic policy is that individuals who have committed illegal acts shall not be permitted to profit financially or be otherwise indemnified for their actions. So the court in Sachs was addressing the very same issue that you have raised today, Your Honor, that what if it's alleged that the lawyer was actually involved in the criminal conduct? And the court in Sachs went on to
but
go.
I see a distinction because in Sachs, the alleged conduct occurred outside of, you know, the courtroom. And here, at its core, the issue is Mr. Byrd is being faced with sanctions, and his attorneys in the courtroom are evidently saying, no, this is totally your fault. You're the one who didn't produce anything to us. You're the one. And that's happening in the courtroom during the court process. And the malpractice that he is alleging is that during their representation of him at the sanctions hearing, there was malpractice. And so I think that there is a distinction.
Your Honor, I would submit that is, of course, an issue, but it's distinct from the issue that was addressed by the court in Sachs. I think that issue is more along the lines of the argument they make that Peeler shouldn't apply because it creates this conflict or motivation on the part of the lawyer during the proceeding to steer things towards a contempt finding in order to secure the protections against a malpractice action. The idea that Mr. Spencer could have had that motivation as that hearing was going on. But that issue, that sort of criticism is a criticism that's been leveled against the Peeler rule by several commentators and by the appellants here. But that criticism is not unique to this situation involving criminal contempt. It's a criticism of Peeler across the board. It's a criticism that suggests Peeler shouldn't apply in any situation because of that potential motivation. And the second fallacy of the argument, I believe, is that Peeler involved that very situation. Peeler involved a situation where the lawyer was representing the criminal defendant and had allegedly failed to advised them of an offer of transactional immunity, an offer that would have completely eliminated any criminal prosecution. The allegation is they failed to do that. The transactional immunity offer was no longer available, and then the lawyer, during the course of the representation, advised the client to plead guilty. And by doing that, created the very sole proximate cause bar that ended up being the basis of Peeler.
But Peeler never denied she was guilty. On her appeal, she never denied she was guilty.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's a difference there as well. Mr. Byrd said he provided the information to his attorney, and his attorney didn't had prepared responses and didn't file them. So there's a distinction there from Peeler as well, is there not?
Well, here again, Your Honor, I think that sort of argument would be available, I believe, to every legal malpractice plaintiff who's involved in criminal conduct. And they're trying to make that criminal conduct the basis of a recovery for damages. I mean, in all of these cases, the plaintiffs are arguing this wasn't the tax cases, and in Sachs, they're arguing it wasn't me that did this. I mean, my lawyer did this, and it's my lawyer's fault. And the point of the...
There's a difference between a lawyer giving advice that you act on and a lawyer failing to file something.
Yes, and the response to that is, I believe, if you look at the transcripts, that he was not found in criminal contempt and did not go to jail for something Mr. Spencer failed to do. As a matter of law, in order for that conviction, which must presume Judge Quisenberry knows the law, that he had to be found to have willfully and knowingly violated the previous court order. Not Mr. Spencer, but Mr. Byrd. And that sort of criminal act is what forms the basis of the sound public policy behind the Peeler decision.
Okay, so the public policy of the Peeler decision concerns what a lawyer did prior to somebody going to jail. How does that same public policy protect what the lawyers did after Mr. Byrd went to jail? Why doesn't he have it, at the very least, have a cause of action for what they did afterwards? How can they be protected after the fact?
Your Honor, the answer to that question is that goes to one of the other arguments they've made, which is this situation should be treated differently because what Mr. Spencer and his firm allegedly did was deprive me of the opportunity to be exonerated. They committed negligence in connection with the writ of habeas corpus. That very argument has been repeatedly rejected by every Texas court that has ever considered it. And in particular, in the context of applications for writs of habeas corpus, they have decided in every case that the loss of an opportunity to be exonerated is not sufficient to overcome the sound public policy behind Peeler. The Owens case talks about it in those terms. The other cases cited in the brief, I believe around page 20, they involve situations where, one, an application was filed in an untimely manner and therefore was not successful. One of them involved a situation where the lawyer was hired to file the application and it was never filed at all. And in every case, the courts say, we are not going to look past the fact that it is this criminal defendant, that their criminal act that is resulting in the damage, and it's not the alleged conduct of the lawyer. The one last thing I'd like to address, if I have the time, is the distinction between what happened in the Duggar versus Arredondo case and what's at issue here. That case involved the illegal acts rule, so to speak, and what they held in that case was it doesn't apply anymore to wrongful death or personal injury cases because of the Chapter 33 proportionate responsibility. And the appellants have suggested that it really tells you that somehow Peeler shouldn't apply in this situation, and I would submit that nothing's further from the truth. What they did in that case was distinguish the Arredondo situation from the unique circumstances presented in Peeler and Sachs and Dover, and which is the same situation presented here. It doesn't involve a situation like Arredondo where someone died, unfortunately, by a heroin overdose, and their mother brought a wrongful death action. In that case, they were seeking damages resulting from the death. in this case and in all the other cases that the court recognizes, they are seeking damages as a direct result of the conviction and incarceration. They're saying that my criminal act, this criminal conduct, should entitle me to recover damages. Not that it's not a situation, in other words, where the bank robber comes into the bank and slips on a puddle of water on the floor and might have a personal injury claim there. The unlawful acts rule is no longer going to prohibit that. It's not the situation where the bank robber, during the course of the bank, gets convicted of that and then turns around and tries to sue his lawyer for example, telling me it was okay to rob the bank. It's a different situation. So I believe that the unusual circumstances that the Texas Supreme Court talks about and what's present here is the fact that we have someone who is trying to profit to the tune of millions of dollars from the very conduct, their own conduct, which we know, the knowing and willful conduct that they committed that sent them to jail. So that's the reason why we would ask the court to affirm the decision.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Thomas.
You don't call a cop when the defendant doesn't respond to discovery in a civil case. The conduct here is fundamentally different from the criminal conduct being discussed in Peeler. In Duggar, the Texas Supreme Court does say that Peeler involved an unusual or a different situation, that being criminal malpractice. Then it went on to say that Dover and a couple of courts of appeal have applied the unlawful acts doctrine in the context of civil cases, citing Dover and Sachs. And we're not going to address today whether that's inconsistent with our opinion today in Duggar, because that issue isn't before us. But it is inconsistent with their opinion in Duggar, and it is before you. And I argue that Dover and Sachs were not only wrongly decided, but they don't survive the reasoning in Duggar. Contempt is also very different. Civil contempt here, the underlying, basically this is a discovery sanction. That's what's going on here. And I don't want to minimize the importance of responding and complying with the court's order to comply with the discovery in a civil case, but we've never made that a penal offense. No Texas court has ever applied Peeler to a contempt, be it civil or criminal. Now, when Peeler says that you have to prove exoneration by appeal, post-conviction relief, or otherwise I take to include executive actions such as pardon, clemency, then you strike off right away two avenues for exoneration for contempt. Appeal is not available, and executive action is not available. Nobody's concerned about the contemner's appellate rights and whether he's entitled to an appellate attorney if he's indigent, because he doesn't have any appellate rights. His only remedy is to pursue habeas corpus, and that's very limited to attempting to show that the order is absolutely void, not just that there was error. So right off the bat, there's a very fundamental difference between the remedies available in a typical criminal prosecution and a contempt proceeding. And the offense just isn't the same. The appellees are taking the cases that discuss contempt and compare it to criminal procedure out of context. Those cases are discussing the situation of what rights should we provide to these defendants because of the similarity in punishment between contempt and a criminal case. The analogy doesn't hold when you're talking about taking rights away and not giving the contemner the same rights as every other civil litigant who's prosecuting a malpractice case. The contempt proceeding in a civil case is often the tail wagging the dog. It is not, unlike a criminal case where guilt-innocence determination is the heart of the dispute and there's a full trial over that issue and a jury charge with respect to the elements. Here we're dealing with contempt being decided in a summary procedure with findings of fact that don't address the contender's actual conduct and actually address conduct that would be that of the attorney. It's a very different situation than a typical criminal case. So far from Peeler being controlling here, it is a huge leap, and in fact, it is an unprecedented leap to apply Peeler to contempt growing out of a civil case. This court shouldn't be the first to apply it. Peeler shouldn't apply to civil cases at all. If there's a rationale for Peeler, it's limited to the unique circumstance, to quote the Supreme Court, the unique circumstance of a criminal malpractice case. Can I answer any further questions? Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Thomas. Mr. Smith, we appreciate your arguments today and your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted and you all will be excused. We will now adjourn court, this concluding our session for today.
All rise.